Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My special guest tonight, longtime friend and longtime friend of WICN, is Irwin Dusty Miller. He is a retired attorney at Bowditch & Dewey. He is WICN's first and only director emeritus and a longtime corporator of WICN. Dusty, it is such a pleasure to talk to you. I've always wanted to sit down and talk to you, not just about your relationship to WICN, but about your travels and your life. But let's start. How long ago did you come to WICN?
Well, I kind of stumbled upon it. It was way back. It was about 1970.
Whoa!
And I was looking for a station that, you know, was not commercial. And I guess I saw something about it. I don't know where, whether it was a telegram or someone said something. And so I tried it. And at the same time, living next to where we finally moved in 1972 on Fenimore Road was an apartment over above in the garage. And two guys were living there, Tom Devlin and Gene Pettit. So I got to know them.
And oh, God.
That's kind of how I got introduced to the station. And then they asked me, you know, because they were trying to get a board that represented the community.
Yeah, yeah.
And Mary Melville, I don't know if you...
I remember Mary Melville really well.
She was a wonderful person, a force of,
yep,
you know, getting the community moved forward in various ways. And so she kind of rounded up some people to get on the board who might have a broader representation of the community and also some power sources. And from there, you know, I got involved. So I finally came on the board, was board chair for a while, got you moved into the swimming pool. And
wait a minute. We're going to go through all parts of that as we go.
Okay.
But I
so
guess
anyway, I've been a listener and a member and I'm still a corporator. For, gosh, must be 50 years.
And as I mentioned in the introduction, you're the first WICN director emeritus, too.
Right.
But this is amazing. First of all, I didn't know that early history of Tom and Gene, that they lived together above a garage. And for people who don't go back with WICN, I came to WICN in, I think, 71. And at that point, WICN was the intercollegiate network.
Right.
And it was several colleges. It was
WPI and Holy Cross.
That's right. And when I started actually doing a show, I recorded it at WPI. But very soon, do you remember who made the decision for it to become an independent station?
I think colleges felt, you know, they'd given them support. And there was a professor, I think his last name was Howe.
That's right, Don Howe.
At WPI.
Yep.
And he was very influential in getting the technology set up and the first transmitter and all that. And it was pretty small and primitive. It didn't have a long range, but
oh, no.
It was the city. And but I think, as often happens, I don't know where GBH actually started. We still have BUR, which is apparently connected to Boston University, though I'm not really sure of the details. But I think it was kind of traditional to spin these stations off when they got enough strength to be supported by the community. And I think that was the objective.
Now, our first off-campus location was on Grove Street.
Yep. Oh, yes.
Oh, my God. Do you remember that, that building a lot?
It was a rat's nest.
Well, I got to tell you a personal problem I had. I was doing the late night rock show. Okay, we didn't have a bathroom in the station. The bathroom was way down the hall. So if you're on the air playing a record, you would have to put on a long cut, as we say, and then run down the hall, do your business, and then run back and hope the door didn't lock behind you, which happened to me several times. It was a rat's nest. It was amazing.
Yeah, it was an old fat manufacturing plant of some kind, and there was a big round, circular sort of sink that all the workers could come and wash their hands or something after their shifts. But it was, you know, and we had a bunch of tiny rooms, and No, it was pretty basic, but you know, I had to start somewhere, and I guess that's what I remember first. So.
What kind of music the WISN played at that time were you attracted to?
Well, I have a wide-ranging taste in music, anywhere from jazz to, you know, folk to classical of various kinds.
We had a lot of classical.
They played all that. They played
all
that.
We did. We do. The only thing we don't play now is classical. We still play everything else.
Yeah, that's right. But in a little more organized way. Glenda Reese was, I don't know if you remember Glenda.
I remember Glenda Reese really well. Her daughter was an assistant for me at the Worcester Art Museum.
Okay, well, she was sort of the classical corner.
I really loved Glenda. I really, really loved Glenda.
There were ethnic shows. There was Lithuanian Hour.
That's right.
Know, those kinds of things. But that's kind of typical of early public radio. They were representing as many niches as possible without having a sort of organized signature of their own.
I always get the feeling it was like one of those movies where it says, hey kids, let's put on a show.
Yeah, kind of, you know, the summer resort minstrel show.
Or, yeah, exactly right. We all just get together.
Talent show.
We all get together and we were just sort of hammering it out as we went along. Can you just paint a little bit of a picture of Tom and Jean brought WICN from that point all the way to the point where it is today? And the amazing thing is that Tom is still on our board of directors.
Oh, that was great. It's kind of a cycle went around. Came back.
I loved it. But Gene was a great figure. I loved Gene. He was tall. He had this big walrus mustache.
Yep. They were different people in many ways, but they worked well together, and they could see, they had the vision.
That's right.
Of what WICN could be. And, you know, I'm sure they're both very pleased to see how it ended up in a major, you know, force in the community. But that was unknown at the time they started all this.
Wow. That was, I mean, there were several pivotal moments on WICN's history, and you were there for all of them. The first one was separating off and becoming an independent non-commercial station. And I think the other one was when we made the big move here, where we are now.
Oh, I think there was something in between, a couple things in between.
There were a couple of things in between. I was being whatever.
Yeah. I used to have parties at my house for the staff and volunteers, you know.
Yep.
It was a real cross-section of the community, and we had a lot of fun. But the first major thing that I remember being involved with was moving the station to what was then owned by Denholm's originally. It was the old YW, and there was a swimming pool there. They were so happy to move into a place that was decent, sort of. They had space for a station, you know, offices and studio, and the record library went to the pool, which was a good place for it.
Dusty, that was one of the weirdest experiences, was pulling records, because the floor was tilted down towards the back,
yeah.
And all our records, and by the way, we played records then, we're down in this pool with the office spaces sort of around it.
Yep, upstairs around the edges of the pool.
Yeah.
And there was, you know, there was a bathroom. It was a much nicer place.
Well, there was a bathroom in the station, which was a huge relief.
Yep.
Yeah.
And roughly around that time, I don't have the exact date, they qualified for belonging to National Public Radio.
That's right.
You know, the Corporation of Public Broadcasting. So that gave them, you know, sort of image, as well as a source of at least modest support from the government.
That's right.
So that was a big move. You've arrived, there you are. You're one of the stations across the country that can claim that. And so I think that was a morale booster, among other things. And then
what also meant the station had to get more serious.
Right.
What I felt is when we moved to Grove Street, I mean, out of Grove Street and into the Denholm's spot, is that there was a sense of, okay, like, we're not just goofing around on the air anymore. So we're going to get serious, and we're going to become a serious radio station.
Well, you began to raise serious money. You know,
had to
show something for it. And then I got involved in an awful lot of other things in town during this and after. So I didn't I kind of stepped back from involvement, and there were lots and lots of people now who could lend their support and expertise. So, of course, the next move was to the Prentice Building, another step upward, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And then Brian Barlow, who sold his own hi-fi business and devoted quite a number of years to leading the station into a position that it really now occupies. Those are all, it's really a rather clear upward progress map.
Yep, exactly. I know, I feel great being here still. After all the time, I just keep feeling like we keep getting better and we may be doing more things and different things, but the station just keeps improving. And that's an amazing thing after all these years. I mean, it's been an incredible journey.
Well, I think that shows the kind of community support and backing and the kind of people involved. I try to get to the annual meetings when they were in person, and I sat at Zoom to see this meeting, and it was so professional, and everybody did their thing, and that was it. It was a real pleasure. And Sheila ran the thing just beautifully. I was very pleased.
She's really good at that. She's really good at that. This is, well, for me, is I have, because I was an on-the-air person, I have my memories of the station fall to a lot of technical things. Like we talked about how we used records. We had a record library. I remember editing reel-to-reel tape so that you would have one hand on one reel, one hand on the other reel, and you would be going back and forth going, and then you would actually cut tape with a razor blade and tape the ends together with a piece of tape. And that's how you used to edit back in the day. And that always just amazed me. But I got to watch, to go from records. We went from records to CD. Actually, we went to tapes, too. And then CDs and then MP3s now. And the technological advances have been incredible.
What a change. We've moved to Briarwood now, and I had so many records, vinyls.
Yeah, but they all came. Records are all in now.
Yeah, so you know, when you were having your record sale coming up, so Melanie and a few other people came over, and they took probably several hundred vinyl records. Well, these were like shows and operas, and I like classical, and that's what I collected mostly, and some folk, and so I don't know what happened to them. I hope somebody found them of interest, but that was the way it started. But then, of course, you had your tape.
That's
right. Didn't last too long.
No.
And then you had your CDs, and I have, in where I moved into, I have a den, and in a couple of racks I have more CDs in number and playing time than I had of the what looked like an awful lot of vinyl records. So, you know, that's one of the big changes.
That's what happened to me, too. Like, I have all my vinyl records stored away because I don't have a record player. But, boy, do I have a lot of CDs. I have a crazy amount of CDs.
So, you know, technology, big changes in 50 years.
Well, let me ask you, I know this is putting you on the spot, but I'm always fascinated by what people say to this. What are some of your favorite recordings or favorite artists? Whatever music.
I liked a lot of the folk groups from the 60s. That's when, of course, I grew up in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
So you know, the whole group of them, whether they were the Beach Boys or
the Kingston Trio. Do you remember all
Kingston
the
Kingston Trio? Yeah. Well, GBH has been running an open sort of program for the last couple of weeks as their fundraising. And they're bringing back either clips of or the actual singers, if they're still around, to have a geriatric encore. and it's amazing. It's amazing. Buffy St. Marie was there.
Oh, yeah. Well, Buffy, Buffy St. Marie is back again.
Yep. And she still got a good voice.
I know. It was amazing. My older brother, who went to Harvard, he started a folk group. and he was actually, and he also played when people came to Cambridge. He would often do the opening act. So at an early age, I used to follow him to coffee houses. in Cambridge and stuff like that. So my background, besides rock and besides classical, has been folk music too. So all those albums were in my house.
But so then I always liked musicals and.
Yeah, yeah.
I was a Gilbert and Sullivan fan.
All right, all right.
I have all of the ones that, including ones that are not so well known, like Utopia Limited and The Grand Duke.
Okay,
the music is great, and the lyrics, of course, are very political. And
wait a minute, I've never heard of either of those.
Well, they're part of the genre.
Was it from their later period, or?
Yeah, sort of. You can get them on CD easily.
Okay. I'm going to have to check them out. Did you see the movie Topsy Turvy?
Yes.
Because that really was that was a great insight into the life.
Well, they didn't always get on too well. But
no.
And Sullivan, of course, was always trying to write grand operas. And he wrote some pretty grand music, as well as some hymns and other things. But, you know, he got, like so many composers or artists, they got kind of cubbyholed by their genre.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Everybody is waiting for him to do that particular kind of music, and so he never really broke out.
Well,
popularly,
you know, when you've written all the, you know, the Pirates of Penzance and everything else, nobody wants to hear your opera, frankly.
Right. I mean, it's a great music, but it just didn't get the kind of public acceptance because those Dolly Cart operas were like the Broadway.
Yeah, yeah.
Of Britain for many years, from the late 1800s to the early 1900s, particularly.
It's an amazing. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My extra special guest tonight is Dusty Miller. He is a retired attorney from Bowditch & Dewey. He is our director emeritus, WICN's first, and he's been a longtime corporator of the station. And we've known each other for a very long time. I think we've known each other through the history of most of the history of the station. I have to ask you, because I just was watching this film, and I never knew this, is that you were you were 25 when you marched with your parents from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama.
Well, yes, and I have to be clear that I did not start at Selma. They did not want any of the people, and there were thousands of people who came down to join the march.
And I remember that.
To go to Selma, because it was a two-lane road from there into the outskirts of Montgomery, it was just not safe, whether you're talking about traffic or perhaps people who were not happy with the
right.
event that was happening. So we all flew into Montgomery during the night, and in the early morning gathered at a place called St. Jude's Field. And then we were well taken care of. It was very well organized. Everybody was seated into the line of marches. It began, and we marched. You know, we marched through, I don't know, 7 or 8 miles of suburbs and parts of Montgomery which were very poor, some of which were black poor, and some of which were white poor. And then into the central city where the state house was, and gathered before that, and Martin Luther King spoke, and the only flags flying were Confederate flags.
Whoa.
Including above the, well, this was 1965.
I know, and you know, people, I think a lot of people, like, I look at my grandchildren today, and they have no idea how serious the situation was then.
We won the Civil War. There was a few years of Reconstruction, and then Jim Crow came.
That's right.
And really, it was apartheid. And it was even harder than the old slave days, because everybody had to live on two levels. Either you were white or you were black, and you had to go. I remember going to Charleston, South Carolina with my family on a train, and we got off, and I had to pee, so I went to, you know, I said men over there, so I started going there. I got yelled at. He said, "Kid, you can't go there. That's not for your type." And I looked up, and yes, it said blacks only.
Wow.
And that was the whole system.
It was especially hard on traveling musicians and artists.
Yeah, you had the Green Book.
That's right. That was the only thing you had. Yeah.
And there was quite I don't know if you've seen the film, but there's a film called The Green Book, which is very interesting, about a classical artist, pianist, who travels the South in a concert tour, and he hires a driver who's his name escapes, but he was one of the well-known actors in the
Lord of the Rings
thing.
Yeah.
And you know, so you see it through those eyes, and he would even go to some very fancy places, you know, to perform, and he'd have to eat dinner somewhere else. They wouldn't serve it because it was just not for people.
And when younger people hear that all that stuff today about the two water fountains and everything else, you get the feeling like, well, that can't happen in America. And that march was, that has to have been life changing for you.
Well, it was certainly well integrated. But I took some pictures, and there's one picture I took which I think says it all. And it's with the interview. One of the things that was, they put a nice interview together. Stephanie Yule from Holy Cross, and they had a videographer, and it was done at the Historical Museum. But one of the pictures I took showed a line of soldiers in one of the poor white sections, which was dangerous without soldiers being there, lining both sides of the road about 50 feet apart. Jeez. And they had their arms with them and everything. And down the middle of the road marched three teenagers, a couple of girls and a boy, or vice versa, I don't remember quite. But, and so you see these kids walking between these people, these soldiers. You think, well, you know, they probably don't realize the significance of this in their own future.
That's right.
That was quite a time.
I've got to ask you, how did you end up there? I mean, were your parents really?
I don't know. There were three marches.
But I mean, was that just something your parents would do?
Yes, but there was much more organization behind it than
okay.
That. The first march in early March, the month of March, took place, you know, with a brutal attack on the marchers was as they crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge.
That's right. That's right.
And a lot of people were injured. And Martin Luther King, of course, it was broken up. And he was planning a second march, and he got wind of what it was going to be even worse. So he said he called it off, and he asked Lyndon Johnson to ask the country to show support. So they hadn't really planned another one, but as soon as they began getting calls from all over the country that there were people willing to go down to Montgomery outskirts in March, the third march was arranged. And so in Massachusetts, a number of groups, including the Council of Churches, arranged for planes to fly down. So there was a group from Worcester, a number of clergy persons and wow. Civilians like myself and my family, who joined. And so overnight, Eastern Airlines, for free, flew us down, landed early in the morning at Montgomery. And there were planes from all over the country, airlines I'd never heard of, just jammed up, parked. And we went to the St. Jude's Field. But so there was a call went out to show support, not just money and talk, but go there.
Right.
So
right.
We had about 25,000 people who descended on the city, including a train down from Atlanta. Atlanta was even then, you know, a very diverse, not what we call a liberal city, but lots of people from different places that would support something like this. So, it was a very large operation as those things go.
Wow.
Got a lot of publicity. And after the march, Congress passed the Civil Rights Act in about 2 weeks.
Yes, yes. I got to ask you, we're almost out of time. How long have you been called Dusty?
Since I was born.
No.
Yes.
Your parents?
Yes.
Why?
I'll tell you why. Well,
we only got like 3 minutes left.
Okay, I'll make it quick. My first name was Irwin, like my father's. I didn't really like it. Well, I was too young to dislike it at that point. But he thought, well, we better have a good nickname. So,
so wait a minute. Did that mean your parents didn't really like the name they came up with?
No, but they thought it'd be confusing if someone was calling Irwin. Which Irwin are you calling? Around the neighborhood or something. So my dad loved to go fishing, salmon fishing particularly. And he had a bunch of friends who go up to New Brunswick and fish in the Miramichi River. So lo and behold, one of his favorite fishing flies was called the Dusty Miller.
That's right. That's actually the it's the name of a moth too. I think.
Well, because the fishing flies are made to look like an
insect.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
To get the salmon excited, there's dinners up there, and then they get hooked. So that's how my name came about, and it was a natural. My dad was a fisherman; he loved that fly, so here I am.
I'm so glad I found that out. It was funny because I've known that was the name of a moth for like a long period of time.
Well. A lot of the fishing flies are named for insects that a fish would like to.
Did you take up fly fishing too?
No, really. I my dad was avid, but he also was quite a bit older. He was 42 when he got married.
Okay.
And by then, I had other interests. So we did go fishing. We took a number of trips up to Canada and fished when I was a teenager or early college age. But, it didn't really take, of course, it was a different time by then. Fishing was more of a thing to do when there wasn't all these other distractions
That's
in
right.
life.
That's right.
But he did it as long as he physically could. So that was a pleasure of his with his friends, and so that's the origin of the name.
We're completely out of time, and I didn't even start to talk to you about your travels. So I think I'm going to have you come back at some point.
Well, like, I got interesting travels from.
Oh my God! Don't start.
Easter Island.
Stop! Because we'll have you back next year.
The opening of the Olympics.
That's
China.
Right. My guest tonight has been Dusty Miller. He's a retired attorney from Boda Chindui. He is the director emeritus of WICN, a longtime corporator and friend of the station, going all the way back to the very beginning. Dusty, it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
My pleasure too, Mark.
You'll listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.